Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years now of collecting films on obsolete formats. Basically, we review films from the VHS era, though not always on VHS. And our film for this episode is 1987's Moonstruck, which is on VHS. Getting it, I believe you said it was a gift from your sister, right?
Yes, I'm pretty confident it was a gift from my sister.
And this is a kind of special movie for me. This is, I believe, the first movie my family rented when we got a VCR. We, you know, put an RCA model something something on layaway at the Middlesex Mall Kmart. Then after 6 months or something, we brought it home. There was a mom and pop independent video store down the street from the house. They even had like sort of like footlights on the shelves, and it would just seem so glamorous to, you know, grab the box and then take that opaque white plastic clamshell home, watch this movie. I was 12, so this movie was about grown-up stuff that was boring. And then not knowing, because he had to rewind the tape, we didn't know you were supposed to hit stop, so we watched the film, and then we watched it in reverse. And that was our first VHS experience. So I thought, why not kick off the new year with, again, the first movie ever watched on home video.
Nice. Well, as Matt mentioned, this, I'm pretty confident this was a gift from my sister, and this is one of our favorite movies that we'd watch together. With it coming out in 87, I didn't see when it came out because I would have been 11 at the time. So it was probably the early 90s that we really got into it. Maybe when I was around like 13 or 14, we really started watching this movie and we'd watch it together. On a personal note, my sister was dating her now husband at the time, who comes from a very Italian family. And I think it kind of connected to us on that level, that my, you know, it just kind of reminded us of some of the personalities and family members for the movie. So I have this great personal connection as well as you do.
Yeah. And also I will say, you know, my father being very Italian, my grandparents not on that side, not being born in this country, both born in the Calabria region of Italy. Revisiting the film now, I was like, oh yeah, that's ethnic.
So I think it's that's ethnic is like a good way to put it. Though this film was really well received. It made $80 million on a $15 million budget. And it received an Academy Award nomination for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Original Screenplay, and one for Cher, Best Actress, Olympia Dukakis, Best Supporting Actress, and for Best Original Screenplay.
Yes.
And John Patrick Shanley, who wrote the screenplay, went on to, is actually a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. And he wrote Doubt, the parable Doubt, the one about the priest being suspected. He wrote that, like that really kind of like deep intellectual, really heady type of play. And then he also wrote Moonstruck, which is kind of like an interesting...
Well, you know, there are these sort of literary elements to the Moonstruck script and the Moonstruck story. There is a, you know, Americans don't really do magic realism. Magic realism is more for, you know, sort of Commonwealth literature, you know, of the British former colonies. But there is a magical, fantastical element to this, this idea of being moonstruck, where it just happens to be this magical Brooklyn where it's a full moon for, what, 3 or 4 days in a row.
Right.
And miracles happen, and there is a whimsy to the play that's very interesting in style of the play, the film, that's very interesting and stylistic, that I can see is at least stylistically consistent.
Right.
A lot of times when films have a fantastic element, it's this disruptive thing that happens that comes out of nowhere. And this idea, I think, of being moonstruck is... really, it's the whole film. The whole film is about being, but there's not really, there's very little time of them not being moonstruck.
Yes.
And for me, one of the interesting early scenes in the film is when Cher and the Danny Aiello character are in the Italian restaurant, and it is this whimsical what you think or hope every time you go into an Italian restaurant that's not Olive Garden, but actually has somebody's name on the door. The experience I think you're trying to buy,
right,
is this place. And they, you know, it's Danny Aiello.
Johnny
character proposing to Cher. And it's so fascinating because there is absolutely no chemistry between those two people. Like, this is not a romantic night out. This is a business lunch.
Yeah, you know, I actually was thinking about this a lot around just kind of how love is presented within this film. And there is this kind of, you know, there's different theories about the different types of love. And there's one, it's like pragmatic love, and where it's just like, it's a transition. Like, I need a husband at this particular time. I need a wife who knows how to cook and clean and take care of the kids. And for that, that very much feels like their relationship. She really wants just somebody to get married to. He is fearing his mom is dying, and there's no one going to be taking care of him, and so he needs someone to mother him. She doesn't have anybody and is getting older, and it feels just like a transition.
It's a good pair of socks.
Yes.
They're a good pair of socks. There's no passion.
No.
Which, again, I think is just beautiful, like, showing, not telling, basic writing 101, basic creative writing 101.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to announce that I mean, that's the other thing, too, is, like, you can't imagine these characters having sex.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, you just can't, or it would be, you know, I guess just missionary, and it would be, like, every third Wednesday from, you know, after the Carson monologue, first commercial break, turn out the light because I have a meeting in the morning, kind of thing. And so... And the Cher character as the main protagonist, I mean, there's the others. This is a nice ensemble cast, though. Yes. She is the main character. She's an accountant. She's super practical throughout. You know, there's this great scene where she's in a funeral home working on the funeral home's bills. And then, you know, she's at a florist and she's like, you know, I don't see the point of flowers. It's just, it's a lot of money for something that's just going to go in the garbage, yeah. Which is, like, so unromantic.
Well, to kind of go back to that scene where you feel like there's no connection, Bobo, the waiter, is complaining that he's losing his best bachelor
customer
to another waiter. And the other waiter says, how do you know? And he's like, oh, he planned it. He's going to propose marriage. He has to get the champagne ready. So it was planned. But he didn't even think about the ring.
Yes, he forgot the ring. He didn't get on one knee.
Yeah.
I don't think the appetizers had shown up yet.
And even in the car on their way to the airport, he's like, oh, he's kind of giving this look of like, oh, did I make the right choice?
Yeah.
And to go back to storytelling, like, I do think they do those cute, those little key little details really tell you about the nature of their particular relationship.
Yeah, and they're also, I think, in a weird way, kind of relatable, right. And it invokes these ideas of, you know, of a Brooklyn, of an Italian-American experience that, yeah.
So going back to that concept of, like, the moonstruck, I really connect this, thinking about the types of romantic comedies that are out there.
Okay.
And so... If you think about it, and let's put it in like almost Shakespearean terms. So there's the Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
And so the, you know, romantic film, there's the, you know, two lovers fighting against odds, that Romeo and Juliet concept. And then there's the other huge romantic comedy trope that most romantic comedies follow, which is boy meets girl. Boy and girl fall for each other, misunderstanding ensues of some sort of misunderstanding. they break apart, but love brings them back together. So in some ways, Much Ado About Nothing. And then, and then you have another type of romantic comedy that you, and that you don't see as often, is this the magical type. So Midsummer Night's Dream, where it's fairies who are coming in, interrupting everything. For Moonstruck, it is the moon.
It's the full moon.
It's the full moon. You know, some romantic comedies might play with all three, but the vast majority of romantic comedies follow this kind of model, or even romantic films follow this model of boy meets girl, some misunderstanding ensues that pulls the lovers apart, but love triumphs all, and they get back together. And that is not at all the structure
of Moonstruck.
Of Moonstruck in any way, shape, or form. And the way it is also so different is that they're older. She's 37. Yeah. Cher's character, Loretta, is 37.
She has gray in her hair.
She has gray in her hair. And also, she doesn't do anything to change to get the guy. Which is also kind of interesting to me because, you know, often a lot of, especially romantic comedy tropes, are that the girl, most likely the girl, transforms in some way. So you think of Grease and Sandy, where she gets on the leather halter top and does up her hair and smokes and, you know, has on the tight-fitting clothes. Loretta doesn't do that. They actually meet, and she meets actually Johnny's brother, Ronnie.
Played by Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage and Nicolas
And again, it's one of the few Nicolas Cage berserker roles where Nicolas Cage berserker works.
Yes.
Where Nicolas Cage berserker is appropriate.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, because this is relatively early in his career. So he would have done Valley Girl, which wasn't huge. He had bit parts in, like, Lifetime, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Rumblefish. Like, he had these roles, Peggy Sue Got Married. But then this would have been...
Really early.
So this would have been a big role for him. And then he went into Raising Arizona and Wild at Heart. And so, like, kind of those Nick Cage that films that you know. So in many ways, this was the first, like, mass audience introduction to Nick Cage. And Nick Cage berserker absolutely works really well. My favorite line is, "Bring me the big knife," in that over-dramatic moment that is that Nick Cage is having.
To explain... You know, so Johnny is going to Italy. His mom is dying. He's now engaged. They have to plan a wedding. That's the other thing, the lack of passion, or the it's a pragmatic love, but it's also really impractical. They don't think about, well, when are we going to get married? Do we pick a date? What are we going to do? There's this whole trope around the Cher character about luck, because she did marry for love before, and he got killed. He got hit by a bus. So she's just like, well, I'm not going to, you know, but bad luck. We have to have a real wedding this time. And you have to get my brother to be there. And so she's the one then in charge of finding the Nick Cage character, whose name is, I forgot already.
Ronnie.
And so Ronnie is a fiery, bad pun intended, I guess, baker who doesn't have a hand, who's missing, he has a wooden hand. And who is, there's bad blood between them. And in this, like, kind of hilarious, fantastical element, you realize that the reason why there's bad blood between them is because Johnny went to Ronnie to buy some bread. Ronnie was distracted, got his hand mangled in the slicer, and he loses his hand and his fiance over this.
Yeah.
And so it's always going to be Johnny's fault. And for 5 years... they don't talk, but, you know, he's got to be at my wedding, and so you got to go talk to him. And so there's this, like, great... And again, it's like, whenever you do anything that's ethnic, you know, there's always that line between, are you having fun with, or are you making fun of?
Yes.
And so this idea of the overdramatic, yelly, fiery Italian... Which I remember the conversations that my dad and his brothers would have about sports every Christmas afternoon at my grandma's house, Grandma Uzia's house. And yeah, I mean, they would just yell at each other. And I remember my mom asking my mom, you know, why are my dad and his brothers yelling? Or my dad and my uncle yelling? And she's like, oh, they're just having a conversation, you know? And so I remember one time my Uncle Sam actually literally standing up and screaming, Altoon! Altoon is the most underrated wide receiver in the National and like had to stand up. And it was like, you know, it was right out of an Arthur Miller play, you know?
Yeah.
Attention must be right, you know, kind of moment. And so, yeah, he has that bring me the big knife. I'm going to cut my throat and show you how much I hate my brother. And it'll be your fault.
I'm laughing because, like, I know you shouldn't be laughing at someone threatening to, but Nick Cage portrayal of the scene for me, it's just so amazing.
It's so over the top. And again, if there isn't that fantastical element to it.
Right.
And then it's like, it becomes cheese ball. But if it's in, you're in a world. You are always aware when you're watching this film that you're in this fantastic Brooklyn that doesn't really exist.
And so,
I mean, for one, there's always parking.
Yeah, you can drive a big car.
There's always going to be a place to park it. Everybody's got a Cadillac or an old...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not Brooklyn.
And so with that, they end up going up to his apartment to talk and get into this very heated discussion about what had happened and the relationships and everything like that.
And she's, again, trying to be sensible, trying to talk him down from the ledge, trying to reason with him.
And he is not reasonable in any way, shape, or form with it. But, you know, in thinking about it, because we watched it last night and we kind of walked away and said, let's take some time to process this movie. Because... actually, romantic comedies are Matt's least preferred film to watch.
Good.
So it actually is something huge to get Matt to watch a romantic comedy. But actually, there's this like amazing scene because they end up telling each other stories. So, you know, Loretta at one point tells him, like, you're not the only one who's ever shed tears, right? So they're both damaged people. She lost her husband. He was hit by a bus and killed. He lost his hand and his fiance. And so they're both very damaged people. And they both have not had relationships or any significant relationships since their tragedies. Mm-hmm. He hasn't dated anyone. And she says, stupid. And he asks, well, any other man since your husband? And she said, Ronnie, his brother. And he says, stupid, you know, stupid you. And so they get into this really great heated debate. But, you know, thinking about this scene, which... the scene is funny because it's like this very passionate scene and she starts yelling at him and her theory is that he's a wolf and he gnawed off his own paw to get out of this bad relationship. And he's very upset about his brother and he says, you know, you're going to look the wrong way and you're going to lose your head. And so he's like, bride without a head. And she's like, wolf without a paw. And they're kind of yelling at each other. But the amazing thing, though, if you step away and think about that, they're both kind of processing their trauma, right? And the damage that has happened to them and their inability to be in relationships. And then, you know, Nick Cage gets up, throws the table, pauses for a second, because you can tell he's like, what am I doing? Pauses for a second.
She cooks him a steak.
She cooks him a steak.
There's that great point where she cooks him a steak. He's like, I like it well done. She's like, no, you're gonna do it raw for it would be good for your blood.
You're gonna eat it
bloody for your blood. And he eats a bite of the steak and he goes, that's good. You know, like.
But there's, so he passionately kisses her. She says, wait a minute, stop. He stops and then she grabs him and kisses him and they end up having sex together.
Yes.
So, but the great thing about it is, so they're having this discussion around how he hasn't had a relationship. The relationship she chooses is Johnny, which as we said at the beginning is a transactional relationship.
Yeah.
Like she's just in relation. And
he's
safe.
He's stable.
And literally,
whatever.
That's what she says. Literally, like I'm going to get a husband. That's what I want. And it's almost like it triggers this, like, but why can't we have passion, right? And they end up having this passionate kiss, and they end up going to bed together. And it's just kind of like this amazing thing of a 37-year-old woman who very much, as I was trying to get to, we kind of meandered off that topic. But she has gray hair. She's not wearing... she's very much wearing an outfit that an accountant would wear.
Yes. Her
hair...
Does
accountant things. She's arguing with him. There's nothing that you would say is like, She didn't show up in a mini skirt with her boobs out and this, like, you know, looking like Cher did in If I Could Turn Back Time.
Yes.
Definitely does not look like that.
Yeah.
But he still finds there's, like, a passion that emerges from there, which, again, in a romantic comedy, it's not supposed to be the gray-haired 37-year-old accountant.
Yes.
Who gets this moment of passion, who has a younger, not necessarily significantly younger, but a younger man who's really into her and is suddenly kind of interested in her. So that's fascinating for me too, because it kind of breaks some of these rules of what a romantic comedy should be.
And so then there's these other elements of romance, because there's also other loves.
Yes.
You know, so the other part of it is the Cher character lives in a multi-family home, or multi-generational family home, I should say, where, you know, she has her parents, she has a grandparent still in the house. The Olympia Dukakis character as her mother, which, again, best supporting actress win for Olympia Dukakis for this character, who is, you know, 60-something? She plays, what, a 60-something at that point? Housewife? Who, you know, this is her life and doesn't have a lot of adventure, and yet there's a possible romance for her. There is this almost, you know, Ibsen-esque ballroom scene at the Met where she bumps into her father with another woman.
Yes.
You know, and what are you doing and what are you doing here? Like, you know, you're not here with your fiance and you're not here with my mom. Kind of moment that happens.
Oh, we should mention her fiancé, Johnny, has gone to Sicily to Palmero to see his supposedly dying mother.
Yes.
And so that's why she kind of has this time to be alone with Ronnie.
Yes.
But yes, so she, Loretta, encounters her father, Cosmo, at the Met with his mistress. And she's there with her fiancé's brother.
Yeah.
And
on the same night, mom goes out to eat and has a flirtation with an NYU professor
who
literally is, like, you know, just got dumped by one of his students.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where literally it's, you know, your place or mine. And she decides, no, that's not who I am. And that's not my life.
Yeah. So it gives these also.
So
these,
you have these other ideas of love and romantic love.
Yeah, I love that it kind of gives you this, like, gradation of what love can be, because with the romantic comedy, it's usually infatuation. It's usually Eros.
And there's usually
Eros, right? It's usually Cupid's arrow has hit you, and you're not.
And maybe the most conventional thing maybe is the Danny Aiello character, that there is this sort of Baxter. There's the guy who's not, who everybody knows right away is not the right guy.
Yeah.
But they're going to end up together.
Yeah, I love I love her dad when she comes home. And the funny thing is, she comes home, she stops to get champagne to tell her parents. So literally, he proposes to her. She drives him to the airport to fly home to Sicily, to Palmero, to see his dying mother. That's their romantic evening after he proposes. Let me drive you to the airport. So she goes home to tell her parents. She tells her father. And, you know, he's so not excited. And he's like, he has this great speech where he's like, I don't like his lips or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't see his teeth when he smiles. I don't like
his
lips.
What's he hiding?
And he says he's a big baby. And he is. Like, you know, Johnny really is. He really just wants a mother figure in his life. And that's their dynamic. You know, she at dinner reminds him not to eat the fish because it'll upset his stomach. She gives him gum for the plane in case his ear pops. You know, when he's in Italy calling her, she says, remember to wear your hat in the sun. So she's very much, that's very much their dynamic of mothering for it. But there's this great, I love this scene where the dad is giving her all the reasons why, why Johnny's a bad choice for her. And even says, why try it again? You have bad luck with marriage. Like, don't even think about it and try it. But I do love that they give you this different looks at what love could be. So you have her parents, Rose and Cosmo, who have been married for a very long time. You know, Cher's 37. She has a brother. Their relationship has stalled. And he's now cheating on Rose. But they also give you these little hints that they actually did have a very romantic relationship for a long time. Rose mentions to Loretta that Loretta's younger brother, She was in her 40s when she had had him. So obviously they had a sexual relationship up into like the 40s. He's now cheating on her, but she still very much loves him. Then you have the aunt and uncle who have this cute, very adorable, friendly, mm-hmm. you can tell they're good friends, but they also have a loving relationship. Mm. You have Loretta and Johnny, which is this kind of transactional relationship. Mm. Then you have Loretta and Ronnie, which is a very passionate relationship. So it's really interesting because you get these glimpses of how different relationships are and can be, and how each one of them works.
Yeah.
Which is also fascinating to see, which within a romantic comedy, that it's just not one type of love. It's just not the passionate type of love. There can be a variety of types of love that occur in a relationship.
Yeah. Are we ready for the bottom five or?
Sure. Let's go for it.
Or the big five, or do you have something else?
No, that's cool.
This movie's still about grown-up stuff for me. I don't know. I'm still 12, I think, watching this film. All right, big five questions. Is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
For me, it's classic. I still thoroughly enjoyed watching the movie as we watched it. I think I like that it does not follow the typical romantic comedy tropes. I like the characters. I think they're very fascinating. I like Loretta's story arc. I like the fact that she's an older woman who has given up on love and giving up on having a relationship, but is still able to have a relationship and is still deserving of a passionate love. Yeah.
And that she's not, I mean, does she really change? I mean, you know what I mean? It's not like she has to change to be with the guy. It's, you know, maybe she has to make a decision.
Yes.
You know, which it works out. I'll go with it classic as well. I think it's a really nice 80s movie.
Yeah,
I mean, it's got to be one of those, like, if you want to understand what 80s movies, 80s Hollywood movies were like.
Right.
I think that's got to be on the list of, like, that's got to be on that syllabus.
And I think, you know, the director did Jesus Christ Superstar. He did Fiddler on the Roof. He did In the Heat of the Night. So the director of the film is just in a, you know, when you look at his list of films, you're like, wow, like, he decided to do Moonstruck. So the direction is really well done, and he pulls great performances from all of his actors.
And they're all really interesting characters.
They are.
I think they're all interesting, and even the Johnny Danny Aiello Baxter character is compelling.
Yeah.
In his being lame.
Yes.
He's still kind of compelling.
Yeah.
And he's still comedic, and he's still sympathetic.
Yeah.
You know, and so. Oh, do I want to ruin the final scene? Because there's this tension in the final scene where everybody is now sitting at this... Again, it's the ballroom at the end, like Ibsen. Everybody's sitting at the kitchen table in that house waiting for Johnny to show up. Whereas, you know, now, you know, and the Cher character has to make this decision between brothers. And, you know, you just think... It's an Italian movie. So there's going to be steak knives. There's going to be curses. There's going to be, you know, I will never speak to you again. You know, kind of Godfather thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
Right.
It gets resolved. Much like a Shakespeare, much like Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah.
It works out.
Yeah.
It works out.
Everything works out.
Yeah. All right. Which maybe is maybe really... So what about the social political distance? This movie came out December 1987.
Yeah, looking at it, so it's set in New York City, and you don't see any other people of color, except
it's an all-white Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a brief shot of kind of maybe African-American children talking about the dogs, because the grandfather has five dogs, but there's no diversity, no real diversity in this film. Now, you know, I was thinking about that, there's no real diversity, but, like, you think very much like a film like Ghost, where there's the mugging, right? Mm. Like, you also would think, it's New York. Is she going to get mugged? And is Ronnie going to save the day? And she realizes how much she loves Ronnie.
Yeah.
Like, no, that doesn't happen, right? Like, and so initially when I first saw the film, there's always that thought of, like, is there going to be this, like, person of color who's the bad guy, who's
yeah,
the
Yeah, those were still some of the bad old days of New York City.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but there's, so it's Koch, bizarre York, yeah. because it is very, all you see are Italian Americans in this film. The one diverse character is the professor, college professor, who's probably Irish.
Yeah.
But that's it. And so that's kind of weird that there's no diversity.
I mean, it does, for me, thinking about it, maybe our generation being that kind of in-between generation between, you know, the 20th century and the 21st, it does remind me of the old-fashioned ethnic enclaves. You know, it's yeah. even like even the Pittsburgh that we moved to in 2000.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, I think at one point, like Polish Hill, something like 90% of the people at one point of the people who lived in Polish Hill
yeah.
were descended from the people who settled Polish Hill.
Well, and I think which that's, is, yeah, I mean, I
you
think,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that, it invokes that old world.
Yeah.
And I think there's that, then that element of you're like, okay, that it invokes, that's how the world was, were those really the good old days?
Correct.
You know, where even like, you know, my grandfather being Slovak in Johnstown, yeah. only lived in the Slovak part of town and only went to the Slovak bars, because if you went to an Irish bar and you were Slovak, that's yeah. tense.
So that's strange. The other yeah. thing is just, I mean, they live in Brooklyn in the massive house. The dad drives a Cadillac.
Yeah.
Johnny drives a Lincoln. And so like, it's weird in the sense of like, you know, that house is probably now a $5-6 million home.
Yeah.
And so I think that's weird. There's actually a funny scene of gentrification, because he's kind of like, Cosmo, the father's a plumber. He goes to do a bid on a house with a waspy couple that, yeah. you know, is a white upper middle class couple. Yeah. And he's talking about the benefits of copper.
Copper pipes.
And so there is that brief sense of like that change that's happening in the neighborhood, that there mm-hmm. are different wealthier people coming in and changing mm-hmm. the neighborhood. But I think gentrification being so really real in New York City, mm-hmm. It was weird. It was weird to see this kind of side of New York City.
Yeah.
And not talk about, say, like the poverty and all that other
yeah.
stuff.
I mean, it does in its fancifulness invoke an idea of old New York.
Yeah.
That's distant. Now, the other thing that we did talk about in terms of distance, though, and again, the two strongest characters, I think, written in the script, the two most well-involved characters, are the two characters who's the actresses won Oscars.
Yes.
Olympia Dukakis and Cher.
Right.
And that the other thing I think is interesting about this film is that the women are in some ways, they are the protagonists. They are the richest characters.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Cosmo is funny. You know, Grandpa barely says anything. He just has his whatever pack of yeah. dogs that he walks. You know, he's only got a few lines in English in the film. You know, Nick Cage berserker.
Yeah.
You know, and it really is Cher and Olympia Dukakis' characters who really are the centerpieces of this film.
Right.
And so I think that's interesting, again, in terms of maybe thinking about gender. Even though it's yeah. a, you know, because again, love is fraught with, you know, and when you get into marriage and business transactions and
yeah.
the roles that you play domestically, like that can be really fraught and for, you know, some women dangerous and
excuse me. Well, I think also thinking about it being in an 80s film, you know, because our parents would have gotten married, you know, my parents got married when they were like 19, 20. They were relatively young when they got married. I think it's also just the generational difference of the sense of, if you're not married by 37, you're done. And so I think there's also that generational distance that's kind of interesting, that Loretta is 37 and she's not married.
Yeah.
And she's a widow, or at least she was yeah. married for a couple of years, but her husband tragically died. But that sense
And you think about it, actually, now that I'm thinking about doing the math, so it was 5 years ago, so 70, so she got married at 30.
Yeah.
Which even then is still
yeah. So she mentions she waited for love, And I believe at the very beginning when she's introduced, they say her married name is Clark. And so it would have been an Irish person that she got married to.
Yeah.
But she does mention that she waited for love and that she wanted to wait for children to have a child. And then he tragically died. But I think there's also that distance of thinking that, like, even at 30 or late 20s, early 30s, people were already viewing her as an old maid. And what is wrong with you? Why haven't you gotten married? So I thought that was an interesting distance as well. So if you're now in your 30s watching it, you're probably like, what's the big deal that she's not married? Who cares?
Yeah.
But at that time, even in the 80s, you think about it, like,
yeah, that would have been
a concern.
I mean, that was around when my sister got married at 18.
Yeah.
And, like, it was the summer she turned 18.
Yeah. Yeah. Where that is that kind of push to get married right after high school or right after college is not, I don't feel it's as there as it used to be in the past. Yeah.
So, all right. Question three. What about the technical distance?
What's your next question? I forget about it.
The room test.
The room. Can I mention one other thing that I think is kind of, before we talk about that, I think it's interesting. So Olympia Dukakis, Rose, is trying to figure out why her husband's cheating on her. And she has no proof.
Yeah.
She has no proof that he's cheating.
But she just knows.
She just knows that there's something different in their relationship.
There's a line early on where she goes to speak. Those that you better go tell your mother.
Yeah.
You know, and so dad's up. Mom is in bed. And she says something like, yeah, and then he's going to fall asleep and not touch me.
He was listening to It Must Be Him.
Yeah.
That song. So she's trying to figure out, why do men cheat on their wives? Why do men run around? And Danny Aiello's character says, a fear of death. And she's like, that's right. And so when Cosmo comes in, after he has just been at the Met with his mistress, she's like, Cosmo, you're going to die. Like,
no matter what you do,
everyone, you're going to die. Which I love that. Love that line in that scene. I think that's also interesting, like, the exploration of why someone might cheat on you.
Yeah.
And you don't really get that a lot in movies of, like,
this is
why
true.
Is that? Why is that? And it's a romantic comedy, but it's a kind of like this almost darker, interesting topic of why do some men feel the need to cheat? And then you have the very obvious professor who's sleeping around with his students, which is that very bad stereotype of him just kind of liking young women and their energy and things like that. But I thought that was also something interesting that we don't really talk about in terms of, you know, relationship dynamics. But I apologize. Go ahead.
That's okay. So, the technical distance, you know, whether it's the effects or the lack of internet in the film.
Yeah. I mean, there was, like, you know, you think about it, like, when Johnny shows up to the house late at night looking for Loretto and mom is like, I don't know where she is. She would have just texted her at that particular moment. You know, that kind of thing, like, oh,
it's how people live, you know.
So that
long distance phone calls,
correct, you know, those type of things.
Yeah.
Oh, and you can even go and you could send somebody off at the airport.
Yeah.
You can't do that anymore.
Yeah. And you know what though, there's a lot of shots of the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of this magical New York. In fact, even on the cover of the box,
yes,
you notice, actually the VHS box, I notice is the Twin Towers.
Yeah,
that's there. I think other than that, I mean, I think the film still looks really good.
It does.
I mean, again, the lack of effects. There's just shots where the moon's really big, and I was actually, when I was watching the credits, there was like literally six people who were in charge of the moon shots, you know, of getting good footage of the moon.
Yeah,
which is, I think, great. And it still looks really good. It still looks really good. And it, again, relies on a story and people.
Well, and I think the benefits of having a really talented director as well. Yeah. Who worked with it.
Yeah. And I think it passes the room test. There is nothing in it that is so bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's funny. I mean, I think Nicolas Cage's wooden hand.
Yeah.
Is, and the scene where he's cutting the steak with his hand, or sometimes he has this, like, the final scene at the kitchen table in the family home, he's got this giant blue glove on the hand. I mean, but I think that's part of the comedy, that's part of the whimsy, that, you know, he's got all this rage and then he tries to hold a fork with his wooden hand while he cuts his steak. And so, is it a keeper?
I think, well, it's a keeper it's a keeper for me.
Yeah.
I think it's a really well done film. And I read an article a few months ago where Nick Cage was being interviewed and talking about his career now and just that his hubris of being younger and that he sometimes would just get, you know, we had this conversation of like the Coen brothers work with, how many films has John Candy been in and Steve Buscemi? It's like, it seems like they have these cast of actors that they like to work with again and again. And Nick Cage, they never worked with again.
And he is the only major actor that did not like working with the Coen brothers.
And just talking about Nick Cage, talking about how, you know, in his career, earlier in his career, he would just do whatever he felt the need to do. Like, he would just like, nope, this is how I think this person is. I don't care what you say. I'm going to play it this way. My favorite one is Peggy Sue Got Married, which was Francis Ford Coppola directed it, his uncle. And he just decided to do this completely ridiculous voice. And his uncle couldn't even convince him not to do this ridiculous voice. And I look at this and I think it's like his instinct was really good for this film. And I think other films, his instincts have been really bad, which has gotten him in trouble. But his instincts for this role were really good. And I think Olivia Dukakis and Cher do amazing jobs with their roles. They're such strong women, so intelligent, so witty and funny and strong. They're just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful characters to see. And again, I keep bringing it up. I like the fact that it's a middle-aged woman able to find love again and being deserving of finding love again. And that it doesn't follow those typical romantic comedy tropes.
Yeah, I'll go with that again. First movie my family ever rented. So it was important. It was real.
Absolutely.
And again, if you want to understand 80s cinema and what kind of what was funny in the 80s,
yeah,
in terms of like that style of humor, Moonstruck is a film I think that has to be on your list to understand the 80s.
Absolutely. So during quarantine, go ahead and check this one out.
Yeah. It's still going to be a couple more months, so check it out. Bye.